the Chicago we will build together, we will celebrate our differences. We will embrace our uniqueness, and we will make certain that all have every opportunity to succeed.
When this actual incident happened, they had to kind of figure out what crime he had committed because there was nothing really on the books about it.
How's the new webcam?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. More big names and businesses join the Brunei boycott. Chicago has its first black lesbian mayor. And technology, privacy, and suicide underscore the web opera. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Rob LaCrone.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 6, 2019. The boycott of Brunei has grown exponentially since the government of Sultan Hassanal Bolkiah began enforcing Islamic law on April 3rd that punishes consensual adult same-gender sex with death by stoning, among several harsh provisions. An earlier boycott included protests outside some of the luxury hotels the Sultan owns and lasted a few months in 2014 when the small East Asian country first announced the move to Islamic law known as Sharia. Actor-activist George Clooney officially relaunched the boycott with an open letter last week, again targeting several high-end hotel properties owned by the Sultan, including the Beverly Hills Hotel and the Dorchester in London. A number of other celebrities soon joined in, including Sir Elton John, Ellen DeGeneres, and Billie Jean King. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet called the new laws cruel and inhumane. The laws were also criticized by the foreign ministers of Germany, France, and Australia. The Sultan issued a brief statement near week's end, insisting that Brunei enforces its own rule of law and called his country fair and happy.
CNN spoke with a few LGBTQ people from Brunei who would disagree. None of them wanted their real names used in the story. One gay man said life in Brunei is really scary. The very aggressive punishment is not something that a human should suffer. Another man fled Brunei in October to escape a probable prison sentence for sedition after he criticized the government in a Facebook post. He now lives in Vancouver and said he was only able to come out after he settled there. Being gay in Brunei was difficult enough without Sharia, he said. A transgender woman who's seeking asylum in Canada said that under Sharia, I would be fined and caned and jailed. Another queer refugee told the news service that, if you feel like you're in danger, I made it out, and you can too.
A number of multinational companies are cutting business ties with the government of Brunei to protest the harsh new laws which also punish heterosexual Muslims with death by stoning for adultery. The global travel agency STA Travel said it would no longer sell flights on Royal Brunei Airlines. STA Travel is a privately owned Swiss conglomerate that claims to be the largest in the world for young travelers. Virgin Australia Airlines stopped offering its staff discounted tickets on Brunei's national carrier. It's the second biggest airline down under after Qantas. Don't be surprised if Qantas soon follows, led by its proudly out CEO. Transport for London is pulling ads promoting Brunei tourism from the city's sprawling public transit system because of, it said, great public sensitivity. Deutsche Bank has banned its staff from staying in any of the Sultan's luxury hotels. And Britain's TV Choice magazine announced on Twitter that its annual TV Choice Awards would not be handed out at London's Sultan-owned Dorchester Hotel, as in previous years. The London-based Financial Times newspaper announced that it, too, was canceling a planned event at the Dorchester. In response to the mounting criticism, social media pages for the Sultan's hotel properties have all but disappeared, even as media statements from many of them insist that they welcome all visitors and do not discriminate. You can read George Clooney's call to boycott letter and see the list of the Sultan's properties, including those in Milan, Paris, and Rome, at thiswayout.org.
The government of the Cayman Islands announced this week that it would appeal the Grand Court's March 29th ruling that denying civil marriage to same-gender couples is unconstitutional. The appeal charges that Chief Justice Anthony Smella's decision overstepped his legal authority by changing marriage laws from the bench. Education Minister Juliana O'Connor Connolly is urging opponents of equality to disrupt the upcoming wedding of Chantel Day and Vicky Bodden-Bush, the victorious lesbian couple in the Grand Court case. The government has already asked the Court of Appeal for a stay of that ruling to prevent their wedding, and those of any other same-gender couples who've already obtained marriage licenses. Premier Alden McLaughlin said that the government had not taken its decision to appeal lightly. He claimed in a speech met with applause in the Legislative Assembly that the appeal was necessary to address significant and potentially far-reaching implications to the Constitution of the Cayman Islands. The Cayman Islands is a self-governing British overseas territory located in the Caribbean Sea. If history is any guide, the Caymans will fail to overturn the Grand Court ruling in a series of appeals that could go all the way to the UK Privy Council. Another British overseas territory tried that route under similar circumstances last year, and Bermuda lost.
As we record this newscast, U.S. Attorney General William Barr already has his hands full defending his refusal to release the long-awaited Mueller report, investigating possible election conspiracy with Russian agents and obstruction of justice by President Donald Trump and or his family, friends, and associates. However, Barr took time to comment this week on reports of the low morale of LGBTQ employees at his Justice Department and the claims that they were leaving in droves because of increasing discrimination against them. Barr responded on April 4th to an open letter signed by a number of queer Justice Department workers last week complaining about the anti-queer environment they've been working under. Their letter included allegations that LGBTQ FBI agents at the Academy were being forced out, and that similar employees at the Bureau of Prisons also faced blatant hostility. The letter was signed by members of DOJ Pride, the agency's LGBTQ group that represents what it says are thousands of employees at the nation's largest law enforcement agency. Barr said that he was troubled by the concerns they expressed. The Attorney General wrote that he has directed the FBI and the Bureau of Prisons to take appropriate action to investigate and address the allegations. Barr also issued an equal opportunity statement that the Justice Department is a workplace free of discriminatory harassment. The last time the Justice Department issued such a statement was during the Obama administration, which means that Donald Trump will probably try to find a way to overturn it.
In other news, the anti-queer fast food chain Chick-fil-A has been denied space in another major airport. This follows the recent rejection by the San Antonio, Texas City Council of the eatery's request for space in the San Antonio International Airport. And now in New York, the Buffalo Niagara International Airport has pulled out of installing a Chick-fil-A in its food court. Chick-fil-A had tried to stave off a boycott a few years ago over its funneling millions of corporate dollars to anti-queer causes by announcing that it was no longer doing that. But recent tax returns uncovered by the news site Think Progress revealed that the company is still supporting anti-queer entities. Led by rabidly homophobic CEO Dan Cathy, the company served up more than $1.8 million to such groups in 2017 alone. The Buffalo Niagara International decision was based on that Think Progress report and pressure from Democratic State Assemblyman from Buffalo, Sean Ryan. After Chick-fil-A's welcome mat was yanked by the agency responsible for allocating space at the airport, Ryan issued a subdued tweet saying that a publicly financed facility like Buffalo Niagara International Airport is not the appropriate venue for a Chick-fil-A restaurant.
And finally, South Bend, Indiana's Democratic Mayor Pete Buttigieg continues to solidify his credentials as the first credible openly queer politician to seek the presidential nomination of a major political party. In a new poll by NBC and the Wall Street Journal, released this week, 68% of U.S. voters say they would feel comfortable or enthusiastic about a candidate who is gay or lesbian. That's a huge jump from the last time voters were asked about it. 53% of the respondents in a similar 2006 poll said that they either had reservations about or were very uncomfortable with the idea. Buttigieg has already raised more than $7 million for his campaign, consisting mostly of relatively small amounts from some 65,000 individual donors. Among the close to 20 Democrats already running or expected to run, that total qualifies Buttigieg to participate in the party's first presidential debates in late June. Buttigieg continues to make the media rounds, ranging from MSNBC to CNN to Fox News. On the March 29th edition of HBO's political comedy show, Real Time with Bill Maher, the host marveled at Mayor Pete's success.
Why are you suddenly rising in the polls?
Well, I think part of it is that people are looking for something completely different. And, you know, we're in this moment. I really believe that often... Well, in a way, we did, right? I mean, each election in many ways produces somebody who's the reverse of what we just had.
True.
And you could argue that it doesn't get more different from this president than a laid-back, intellectual, young gay mayor from the Midwest.
No.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending April 6, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Borden, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast.
And now, you can be the first on your block to hear News Wrap each week by subscribing to our This Way Out Radio YouTube channel. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Rob LeCrone.
It was important for me to not just judge these characters, but put our audience in their same position where we see them violate someone's privacy, but we are violating theirs at the same time.
His roommate kicked him out, got a date. Violin boy, good for him.
The web opera streams the story of a gay student's suicide later in the program. Several U.S. cities are deciding that if they want the job done right, they should give it to a lesbian. This Way Out's Lucia Chappelle has the story.
Chicago activist Lori Lightfoot won a landslide victory to become the city's mayor on April 2nd. Either candidate would have become the first African-American woman to lead the third largest city in the U.S., but Lightfoot scored a double landmark by being the first LGBTQ mayor. A newcomer to electoral politics, she replaces the controversial former chief of staff to President Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel. Lightfoot's overwhelming election over Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle was seen as a reaction against the establishment. Her family joined her on the stage as she claimed victory.
Out there tonight, a lot of little girls and boys are watching. They're watching us. And they're seeing the beginning of something, well, a little bit different. They're seeing a city reborn, a city where it doesn't matter what color you are, and where it certainly doesn't matter how tall you are. Where it doesn't matter who you love, just as long as you love. Let me say that again. Where it doesn't matter who you love, just as long as you love with all your heart. In the Chicago we will build together, we will celebrate our differences. We will embrace our uniqueness, and we will make certain that all have every opportunity to succeed. We made it. And I sure wouldn't have made it without my wife, Amy, and our daughter, Vivian. I want to thank you both for your endless inspiration, your support at the toughest times, and your undying love. You are my all, my everything.
Lori Lightfoot won 74% of the vote in the mayor's race, but not all civil rights activists are confident about how she will run Chicago. Their concerns are based on her role as a former prosecutor and as head of a police disciplinary agency. Lightfoot's win in Chicago overshadowed the successes of two other lesbians in mayoral races on April 2nd. Satya Rhodes Conway was elected mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. Jolie Justice was the leader in a primary vote for mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, where the final election will be held on June 18th. For This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
Hello, I'm Randall Kleiser, director of Grease, Blue Lagoon, White Fang, and It's My Party, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities. LGBTQ-themed operas are still relatively rare, but two daring artists are trying to change that. It's not just the storyline that breaks new ground, it stretches the boundaries in style as well. This Way Out's Christopher Gall sat down with the composer and director whose work is now streaming online.
The Web Opera is a short contemporary opera in three episodes. It is the brainchild of composer Michael Roth, who has written music for over 100 plays and theatrical performances, as well as chamber music and film scores. Kate Jobson directed the film. She has many films and plays to her credit and is the artistic director of Circle X Theater here in Los Angeles. Michael and Kate, thanks for joining us on This Way Out.
Thank you.
What is the Web Opera?
So it's a film and opera fusion piece, and it follows the story of a group of college freshmen and when one of them installs a webcam, how their lives unfold from that simple everyday event.
The story, it's loosely based on the story of Tyler Clementi, who's the college student who died by suicide in 2010 after his roommate surreptitiously recorded him being sexually intimate with another man.
Just to correct it, he never recorded him. You know.
It was live streamed.
Right. It was live streamed.
So, yeah.
Right.
What drew you to this story?
The more I read about it, the more I thought that what the incident that happened here is thoroughly unique to the world we're living in now. In other words, when I was a college student, the idea of posting something about somebody was something that you did in real time with a piece of paper and a thumbtack. But now, because so much of our lives are communicating online, the circumstances around this are just so unique to our time and present the problems that of bad communication, miscommunication, and also selfishness of cruelty, of doing things. So when this actual incident happened, they had to kind of figure out what crime he had committed because there was nothing really on the books about it yet, you know? So that was just very interesting to me as a contemporary dilemma of where we're at now.
Let's listen to a clip from episode one.
Okay.
This is actor Ruben Uy as FG97. The characters are known by their
email addresses,
their screen names.
Right.
And in this clip, he's doing two things. He's texting with a friend and he's Googling his future roommate and he makes a discovery.
How's the new webcam? Porn. Registered at a porn site. Yeah, the camera's good. Waiting for your roommate. No, he's gonna be late. Just us boys. Registered at Just Us. How late? What goes on at Just Us Boys? Good to know.
Ruben Uy in the Web Opera. I'm Christopher Gall for This Way Out. My guests are director Michael Roth and Kate Jobson, the composer and director, respectively, of the Web Opera. One of the themes in the work is how technology mediates our existence, especially young people today. The entire film is shot with the actors facing the camera, looking right at us, with their computer screens in the middle. And in full disclosure, I worked on this.
Yes.
I did some of the motion graphics in episode 3 of these on-screen graphics.
Yes.
What was the approach to capturing that relationship between technology and humanity?
Well, something that was really important for me was that everything that you see is through different devices. So there's times where you're seeing things through their phone, through their iPad, through the screen itself. And it's different than them filming videos for the public. Like, it's actually the private moments that they wouldn't share. Like in that clip, you can hear him. It's really his internal dialogue, you know, as he's reading the messages that are coming from his friend, as he's typing the messages, as he's Googling things. So you're really looking into these private moments with this feeling that you could be violating their own intimacy and privacy, even in the first episode, where you're watching him set up this webcam and chat with things and Google people. So it was important for me to not just judge these characters, but put our audience in their same position where we see them violate someone's privacy, but we're violating theirs at the same time. And there's something that's almost uncomfortable, but fascinating about watching these little minute moments and trying to find these little minute textures that help provide realism. And then, of course, the graphics that are in there provide us a window into what they're seeing. And also we did it a little bit more emotionally or expressively. So it's just like the voices that they're, when they're singing, of course, in reality, we wouldn't be hearing that, but we're getting a window inside their brain as well. So it's that extra level of closeness beyond what you would get if you were just watching them on a screen.
Musically, what influences were you using to bring those themes that we've been talking about into the piece?
So there's a part of me that is very much an old rock and roll boy from Long Island who played in bands, and there's a part of me that's a very much contemporary classical composer. As I get older, all those things start, the divisions between those mean nothing. They all kind of come out at me at the same time. And what I find is that they come out in counterpoint and which is contradistinction, which is automatically dramatic. In other words, there are lines attacking each other musically at the same time that hopefully adds to the dramatic tension.
When Michael was talking about how these different musical lines are providing counterpoint and hitting each other, you see that happening with the characters in the piece, of the fact that there's so much that they're thinking about. There's, you know, they're multitasking all the time. There's 20 different things happening. And so no one thing gets their attention, which is how you have this moment of casual cruelty occur, is that because they're distracted, they're not focusing, they're not thinking beyond their present to thinking 10 steps later, because they have got so much that is saturating their present moment.
Let's listen to another clip from episode 2. This is the Tyler Clementi character, Violinist 98, it's the screen name, played by Adam von Hellman. And he's in his dorm room. He's lonely and frustrated.
I walk the streets, watch rain in my two cocked hands, and see a single moment when somebody whispers your fantastic. I whisper you're fantastic too. I walk the street.
My guests are director Michael Roth and Kate Jobson, the composer and director, respectively, of the web opera. There seem to be two forces running through this part of the piece, but also the piece in general. On the part of the other characters, you were talking about the casual cruelty and a cavalier homophobia that's in there.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not much older than these characters. I'm maybe like 5 or 6 years older than them. And I do see a real shift that's happening in terms of a greater acceptance of homosexuality. But I think there's still these latent phobias and fears that are woven in there because people aren't having necessarily open conversations about it. And so you see that being woven into especially episode one, where he's looking and finding this gay porn website that the character we meet in episode two, his roommate, goes to. And his reaction is one of discomfort. It's not outright vitriol and hatred, but there's this uneasiness he feels that's there. And so really talking about these different layers of homophobia that can exist in our society that aren't necessarily blatant, calling names or calling out of people, but these subtle ways that can still influence people. And I think part of what we're saying is that these gestures that might seem, as you said, cavalierly homophobic, which I think is a good term, mm-hmm. is those are still homophobic, even right. if the person isn't thinking they are.
Right.
It still has that intent. It can still damage people in the same way. So there's a lot of times people get defensive saying, oh, I didn't intend it that way. But there was obviously, as I said, these little discomforts, these other things that caused him to post this tweet in this way that created real harm about for Tyler in the real world and for Violin Boy in our world. So hoping that people become a little bit more aware of how they're framing things and digging more into themselves to understand where their own prejudices lie.
I've been talking with composer Michael Roth and director Kate Jobson about The Web Opera. The three episodes are available to view for free at thewebopera.com. We'll go out with a clip from episode three, in which almost the whole cast of the opera discuss the webcam. This is Ruben Uy, Stephanie Cecile Yavalo, Molly Connor, Joyce Lay, and Lauren Badley. Michael and Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Christopher Gall for This Way Out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Carol Myers and Rob LaCrone, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Lucia Chappell and Christopher Gall. Some of the music you heard came from The Web Opera, and Kim Wilson, composer, performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WORT Madison, Wisconsin, CJLY Nelson, British Columbia, KKFI Kansas City, Missouri, and some 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.